I shall now say a few words of our present miseries. A few of us have survived them, but this is not due to anything we have done ourselves, but to the mercy of the Lord. Savage tribes in countless numbers have overrun all parts of Gaul. The whole country, between the Alps and the Pyrenees, between the Rhine and the ocean, has been laid waste by hordes of Quadi, Vandals, Sarmatians, Alans, Gepids, Heruls, Saxons, Burgundians, Alemanni, and, alas for the Commonwealth, even Pannonians. The once noble city of Moguntiacum has been captured and destroyed. In its church, many thousands have been massacred. The powerful city of Rem, the Ambiani, the Altrabarte, Spires, and Strasbourg have fallen to Germany, while the provinces of Aquitaine are, with the exception of a few cities, one universal scene of desolation. And those which the sword spares without, famine ravages within. For 30 years, the barbarians burst the barrier of the Danube and fought in the heart of the Roman Empire. Long use dried our tears, for all but a few old people had been born either in captivity or during a blockade, and consequently, they did not miss a liberty which they had never known. Yet who will hereafter credit the fact, or what histories will seriously discuss it, that Rome has to fight within her own borders not for glory, but for bare life? And that she does not even fight but buys the right to exist by giving gold and sacrificing all her substance. Even Hannibal, who swept like a devastating storm from Spain into Italy, although he came within sight of the city, did not dare to lay siege to it. Even Pyrrhus was so completely bound by the spell of the Roman name that, destroying everything that came in his way, he yet withdrew from its vicinity. And victor though he was, did not presume to gaze upon what he had learned to be a city of kings. But now, even if complete success attends our arms, we can wrest nothing from our vanquished foes but what we have already lost to them. The poet Lucan describes the power of the city in a glowing passage, saying, "If Rome be weak, where shall we look for strength?" We may vary his words and say, "If Rome be lost, where shall we look for help?" Now Hulagu Khan commanded all those subject to him to go against the Tajik capital, Baghdad, which was the seat of the Tajik dominion. The king who sat in Baghdad was not called Sultan or Melik, as the Turkish, Iranian, or Kurdish autocrats customarily are, but Caliph, that is, a descendant of Mahmet. The great Hulagu went against the Caliph with a countless multitude, composed of all the peoples subject to him. This was done in the autumn and winter seasons because of the severe heat of that country in the summer. Prior to his departure, he ordered Baiju and the troops with him to go into the land of the Sultan of Rum, to go and surround the great Tigris River on which the city of Baghdad was built, so that no one could flee by boat from the city. They immediately obeyed the command, tying pontoon bridges across the great river and sinking between the surface of the river and its bed sturdy fences with iron hooks and pipes, so that no one depart the city swimming without them knowing about it. Now Caliph Mustasa, who resided in the city, proudly and presumptuously sent many troops against those guarding the river. The Caliph's men were under the command of a chief named Davat Dar, Ostikan of his house. Davat Dar went and at first triumphed, killing some 3,000 Tartars. When evening fell, he sat eating and drinking without a care, and he sent messages to Caliph Mustasa saying, "I defeated all of them, and tomorrow I will do away with the few survivors." But the crafty and ingenious Tatar army spent the entire night arming and organizing. They surrounded the Tajik army. At daybreak, they put their swords to work, destroying the entire group and throwing them into the river. Only a few men escaped. That same morning, the great Hulagu Khan surrounded the city of Baghdad, stationing everyone at arm's length from the wall and telling them to demolish it and guard that no one escape. He sent valiant emissaries to the Caliph so that he would come out obediently and pay taxes to the Khan. But the Caliph gave a stern reply full of insults, claiming to be lord of the sea and land and boasting about the magical banner of Mahmet, saying, "It is here and if I touch it, you and the entire world will be destroyed. You are a dog, a Turk. Why should I pay taxes to you or obey you? However, Hulagu did not become aggravated because of the insults, nor did he write any boasts. He merely said, God knows what he does. Then he ordered the wall demolished, and they demolished it. He said to rebuild it again and guard it carefully, and they did so. The city was full of soldiers and people. For 7 days they stood on the walls, but no one shot arrows at them, nor were swords used, either by the citizens or by the Tatar soldiers. But after 7 days, the citizens began to request peace and come to Hulagu with affection and submission. And Hulagu ordered that this be done, that peace be made. Then countless multitudes came through the city gates, climbing over each other to see who would reach him first. Hulagu divided up among the soldiers those who came out, and ordered the soldiers to take them far from the city and kill them secretly so that the others would not know. They killed all of them. 4 days later, Caliph Mustasa also emerged with his two sons, with all the grandees and much gold, silver, and precious stones as fitting gifts for Hulagu and his nobles. At first, Hulagu honored him, reproaching him for dallying and not coming to him quickly. But then he asked the Caliph, "What are you, God or man?" And the Caliph said, "I am a man and the servant of God." Hulagu asked, "Well, did God tell you to insult me and to call me a dog and not give food and drink to God's dog? Now, in hunger, the dog of God shall devour you." And he killed him with his own hands. "That," he said, "is an honor for you, because I killed you myself and did not give you to another for killing." He ordered one of his own sons to slay one of the Caliph's sons, while he gave the other son as a sacrifice to the Tigris River. And he said, "This man caused much blood to flow through pride. Let him go and answer to God, and may we be innocent." Hulagu then ordered the troops guarding the walls to descend and kill the inhabitants of the city, great and small. They organized as though harvesting a field, and cut down countless, innumerable multitudes of men, women, and children. For 40 days, they did not stop. Then they grew weary and stopped killing. Their hands grew tired. They took the others for sale. They destroyed mercilessly. However, Hulagu's wife, the senior Khatun, named Dokuz Khatan, was a Christian. She spared the Christians of Baghdad, Nestorians, and other denominations, and beseeched her husband not to kill them. And so he spared them, with their goods and property. Hulagu ordered all his soldiers to take the goods and property of the city. They all loaded up with gold, silver, precious stones, pearls, and costly garments, for it was an extremely rich city, unequaled on earth. Hulagu himself took as his share the Caliph's treasures, 3,000 camel loads, and there was no counting the horses, mules, and asses. Other houses, full of treasure, he sealed with his ring and left guards, for he was unable to take everything since there was so much. 515 years had elapsed since the city was built, and it had taken everything into its kingdom like an insatiable bloodsucker, swallowing up the entire world. It was destroyed in 1258, paying the blood price for the blood it had caused to flow and for the evil it had wrought. Baghdad was taken on the first day of Lent. First and foremost, we must recall how the great, noble, and most powerful imperial city located in Greek territory and called Constantinople was conquered and taken by the Turkish emperor. This is found written here, and it happened on the 28th of May, 1452, that is 4 days after the Feast of St. Urban. When the old Turkish emperor was on his deathbed, he ordered his son, the present Turkish emperor, not to wage war against the Greeks or against Constantinople, or else he would curse him, to which the son responded, "Even if you wish to curse me, father, I shall begin a war against the Emperor of Constantinople the moment you have expired, since if I defeat him, I will become master of the entire world. Later on, he began to build a fortress about 2 German miles from the perimeter, in the outskirts of Constantinople, and he built it so that it was like a fork, as a challenge to the lordship of Constantinople in a place where the emperors of Constantinople had their hunting reserve. The citizens of Constantinople, however, were unaware of this, and considered it as the building project of a neighbor. When Mehmet realized this, he awaited the beginning of the grain harvest, and then killed as many of them as he could take. This was the beginning of the undeclared war. When news reached the Emperor of Constantinople that his people had been killed by the Turk, he left the city, found 500 Turks, and killed 300 of them. Then, since a massacre had occurred on both sides, the Emperor of Constantinople sent an embassy to the Turk to ask him why he had behaved in this way, since he knew that his father had established in writing friendly relations between them. The Turk, however, did not send a reply. He sang and awaited the grape harvest. Then, with 50,000 men, he advanced, killed people, uprooted the vines, and blockaded the city. He entrusted the blockade and the 50,000 men to his feudatory. The Turkish emperor encamped in front of the gate called St. Romanus, before which he placed his cannons. The projectile of the first cannon had a circumference of 12 spans, and those of the other cannons a circumference not much smaller. He deployed them at a distance from the gate. After they had come close to the city, during the night they brought up a war machine, with 10,000 men and the cannons behind it. The war machine was square, like a house, and moved on wheels. The Turks hid inside and began to dig underground up to the walls of the city. There they constructed a wooden shelter and retreat with openings on the sides through which they shot. Scarcely could someone poke his head above the wall before they shot him dead. Later on, the Turks moved in front of the gate called Ventura, and there built a wooden tower encased in leather and skins and covered by a net in such a way as to prevent the stones being thrown at them from harming it. Under this tower, they began to dig a tunnel, which passed under the walls and under the trench around the city until finally reaching the suburbs. But those inside the city had also begun a tunnel in order to get out, and it happened that the two tunnels met. The Turks had with them cannons and other materials, but those from the city started a fire, and thus burned many Turks. Later, the Turks occupied the hills above Pera and had great ships brought over them, 2,200 galleys and longboats, which were placed on rollers and pulled with oxen and mules followed by armed men. When they reached the top, they were allowed to slide down into the sea, into the water between Constantinople and Pera in the middle of the fortified zone. When the Turks then drew near to Pera in the fortified zone, they seized all the boats they could find and bound them together so as to form a bridge, which permitted the combatants to fight on the water just as they did on land. The Turks had with them thousands of ladders, which they placed against the walls right at the place which they had fired their cannon and breached the wall. And so at dawn, on Monday the 29th of May, they began an attack that lasted all night until Tuesday evening, and they conquered the city. The commander of the Genoese, who was leading the defense of the breach, pretended to be wounded and abandoned his battle station, taking with him all his people. When the emperor of the Greeks saw this, he exclaimed in a loud voice, "My God, I have been betrayed," and he suddenly appeared with his people, exhorting others to stand firm and defend themselves. But then the gate was opened, and the crush of people became such that the emperor himself and his 91,000 men were killed by the Turks and the traitors. Afterwards, the Turks ran to the Hagia Sophia, and all those whom they had imprisoned there, they killed in the first heat of rage. Those whom they found later, they bound with a cord around their neck, and their hands were tied behind their backs, and they led them out of the city. When the Turks learned that the emperor had been killed in Constantinople, they captured the Grand Duke who was governing in the emperor's stead, and had the Grand Duke's son beheaded, and then the Grand Duke himself. Then they seized one of the Grand Duke's daughters, who was quite beautiful. Then the most brutish of the Turks seized the finest noblewomen, virgins, and nuns of the city. They then destroyed all the sacred objects and the bodies of the saints and burnt everything they found, save for the cross, the nail, and the clothing of Christ. No one knows where those relics ended up. No one's found them. They also wanted to desecrate the image of the Virgin of St. Luke by stabbing 600 people in front of it, one after another, like madmen. Then they took prisoner all those who fell into their hands, tied them with a rope around their neck, and calculated the value of each one. Women had to redeem themselves with their own bodies, men by fornicating with their hands or some other means. Whoever was able to pay the assessed amount could remain in his faith, and whoever refused had to die. The Turk who had become governor of Constantinople, named Suleiman in German, occupied the temple of Hagia Sophia to practice his faith there. For 3 days, the Turks sacked and pillaged the city, and each kept whatever he found, people and goods, and did with them whatever he wished. With Mehmet, there was a prince who had said that he would not succeed in conquering the city. To him, the emperor of the Turks had said, "If I conquer it, what should I do with you?" And the other replied, "You can cut off my head." And so he did. As for Constantinople, it is so big that it is not possible to travel the circumference of its walls in a whole day, even riding on horseback. It had many soldiers at its disposal, without counting women and children. Indeed, it had a double wall, towards the land and one towards the sea. The ring-shaped walls had 1,100 gates and enclosed 100 churches. When the Spaniards left Tenochtitlan, the Aztecs thought they had departed for good and would never return. Therefore, they repaired and decorated the temple of their god, sweeping it clean and throwing out all the dirt and wreckage. Then the 8th month arrived, and the Aztecs celebrated it as always. They adorned the impersonators of the gods, all those who played parts of gods in the ceremonies, decking them with necklaces and turquoise masks and dressing them in the sacred clothing. This clothing was made of quetzal feathers, eagle feathers, and yellow parrot feathers. But when the Spaniards were outside the city, a great plague broke out here in Tenochtitlan. It began to spread during the 13th month and lasted for 70 days, striking everywhere in the city and killing a vast number of our people. Sores erupted on our faces, our breasts, our bellies. We were covered with agonizing sores from head to foot. The illness was so dreadful that no one could walk or move. The sick were so utterly helpless that they could only lie on their beds like corpses, unable to move their limbs or even their heads. If they did move their bodies, they screamed with pain. A great many died from this plague, and many others died of hunger. They couldn't get up to search for food, and everyone else was too sick to care for them, so they starved to death in their beds. Some people came down with a milder form of the disease. They suffered less than the others and made a good recovery, but they could not escape entirely. Their looks were ravaged, for wherever a sore broke out, it gouged an ugly pockmark in the skin, and a few of the survivors were left completely blind. By the time the danger was recognized, the plague was so well established that nothing could halt it, and eventually it spread all the way to Chalco. And now, the Spaniards came back again. The first battle began outside Tlatelolco, either at the ash pits or at the place called the Point of the Alders. Our warriors put the enemy to flight, and not a single Aztec was killed. The Spaniards tried a second advance, but our warriors attacked their boats, loosing such a storm of arrows that the Spaniards were forced to retreat. Cortes, however, moved his headquarters to just outside the city. Heavy fighting ensued, but the Aztecs could not dislodge him. The Spaniards now decided to attack Tenochtitlan and destroy its people. The cannons were mounted in the ships, the sails were raised, and the fleet moved out onto the lake. The flagship led the way, flying a great linen standard with Cortes's coat of arms. The soldiers beat their drums and blew their trumpets. They played their flutes and whistles. When the ships approached, the people were terrified at the sight. They gathered their children into canoes and fled helter-skelter across the lake, moaning with fear and paddling as swiftly as they could. They left all their possessions behind them and abandoned their little farms without looking back. Our enemies seized all our possessions, They gathered up everything they could find and loaded it into the ships in great bundles. They stole our cloaks and blankets, our battle dress, our tabors and drums, and carried them all away. When the Spaniards reached Xoloco, near the entrance to Tenochtitlan, they found that the Indians had built a wall across the road to block their progress. They destroyed it with 4 shots from the largest cannon. The first shot did little harm, but the second split it and the third opened a great hole. With the 4th shot, the wall lay in ruins on the ground. 2 of the ships, both with cannons mounted in their bows, attacked a flotilla of our shielded canoes. The cannons were fired into the thick of the flotilla wherever the canoes were crowded closest together. Many of our warriors were killed outright, others drowned because they were too crippled by their wounds to swim away. The water was red with the blood of the dead and the dying. Those who were hit by the steel arrows were also doomed. They died instantly and sank to the bottom of the lake. The Spanish blockade caused great anguish in the city. The people were tormented by hunger and many starved to death. There was no fresh water to drink, only stagnant water and the brine of the lake, and many people died of dysentery. The only food was lizards, swallows, corn cobs, and the salt grasses of the lake. The people also ate water lilies and chewed on deer hides and pieces of leather. They roasted and seared and scorched whatever they could find and then ate it. They ate the bitterest weeds and even dirt. Nothing can compare with the horrors of that siege and the agonies of the starving. We were so weakened by hunger that, little by little, the enemy forced us to retreat. Little by little, they forced us to the wall. On one occasion, 4 Spanish cavalrymen entered the marketplace. They rode through it in a great circle, stabbing and killing many of our warriors and trampling everything under their horses' hooves. It was at this same time that the Spaniards set fire to the temple and burnt it to the ground. Flames and smoke leapt high into the air with a terrible roar. The people wept when they saw their temple on fire. At nightfall, it began to rain, but it was more like a heavy dew than a rain. Suddenly, the omen appeared, blazing like a great bonfire in the sky. It wheeled in enormous spirals like a whirlwind and gave off a shower of sparks and red-hot coals, some great and some little. It also made loud noises, rumbling and hissing like a metal tube placed over a fire. It circled the wall nearest the lake house and then hovered for a while above Coyanacasco. From there it moved out into the middle of the lake, where it suddenly disappeared. No one cried out when this omen came into view. The people knew what it meant, and they watched it in silence. Nothing whatever occurred on the following day. Our warriors and the Spanish soldiers merely waited in their positions. Cortés kept a constant watch. His officers stood around him, talking amongst themselves. The Aztec leaders gathered to discuss what they should do. The nobles tried to determine how much tribute they would have to pay and how best to surrender to the strangers. Then the nobles put Cuauhtémoc into a war canoe with only 3 men to accompany him. When the people saw their chief departing, they wept and cried out, "Our youngest prince is leaving us. He's going to surrender to the Spaniards. He's going to surrender to the gods." The Spaniards came out to meet him. They took him by the hand, led him up to the rooftop, and brought him into the presence of Cortés. The captain stared at him for a moment and then patted him on the head. Then he gestured towards a chair and the 2 leaders sat down side by side. The Spaniards began to shoot off their cannons, but they were not trying to hit anyone. They merely loaded and fired, and the cannonballs flew over the Indians' heads. Cortés called the chiefs together and asked them, "Where is the gold you were hiding in the city?" The Aztecs then unloaded it from the canoes. They heaped it in front of the captain, and the Spaniards came forward to take possession of it. Cortés then said, "Is this all the gold in the city? You must bring me all of it."